Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Diogenes was indecent. Nietzsche was a neat freak. Descartes hallucinated. Rousseau was a bum to his kids. Socrates was the great example, at least according to Plato. The philosopher greats have instructed us on how to live, but their lives instruct us too. This hour on Point, how to live and how they lived. You can join the conversation. Who's your philosopher guide? Is it Oprah, Aristotle, Socrates, Seneca, some blogger? Do you care how they've actually lived? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is James Miller, professor of politics and chair of liberal studies at the New School for Social Research. He's written on Foucault, Rousseau, rock and roll, history, and the philosophers. His new book is Examined Lives from Socrates to Nietzsche. James Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
What? This is terrific fun, but it also gets at some kind of deep itch that we all have. I wish you'd, just to start us off so people can have these in the back of their mind, just roll off the 12 philosophers that we're going to talk about, at least as much as we can get to in this hour. Who are the 12 you're looking at?
Well, the 12 I included in my book, and it's a somewhat arbitrary list because the who was in and who was out kept changing as I was writing.
Okay.
But I start with Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Diogenes the Cynic, Seneca, who was a counselor to Nero, Augustine, Montaigne, Descartes, Rousseau, Kant, Emerson, Nietzsche.
That's quite a list. And you're looking here at both the heart of their philosophy and really the sort of most telling moments of their lives. And I want to get to both, but let me ask you first, because after I'd gone through so much of this, I come to your epilogue. And you said something that struck me, and it may be on the minds of some listeners today who may not have had much to do with these philosophers in their life. Or maybe they have, but maybe they haven't. You write, Jim, you say, at the start of the 21st century, we lack the specific spiritual resources and cultural contexts that made feasible the characteristic 19th century quests of Emerson and Nietzsche, never mind the early modern lives of Montaigne and Descartes or such ancient exemplars as Socrates, Plato, Seneca, and Augustine. If we lack the spiritual and resources and cultural contexts, do these philosophers still matter? Do their lives still matter to us?
Well, I think they matter, but what I really meant to forestall by writing that sentence is I think the moral of the story for me is not that anybody should run out and imitate any one of these people. I think such imitation would be basically doomed to failure. The real challenge, which I think crystallized for Ralph Waldo Emerson, is to become self-reliant and to elaborate a character of your own without the need to lean on prior exemplars.
Become self-reliant and elaborate a character of your
own.
Drawing on whomever you may do to do that, whether it's Oprah or Aristotle, I don't know these days. You remind us, and this is a great backdrop for this. In fact, you're giving us a kind of extension of it, that there's an enormous history that we may not feel at all in touch with today about not just reading philosophy, but looking at the lives of the philosophers themselves. That there's an enormous tradition of that as a focus for learning how to live. Remind us of that tradition.
Well, the purpose of the book was to restore what I think had been a somewhat overshadowed tradition in which philosophy wasn't just a matter of doctrines, it was a matter of how one lived one's life. And to study a philosophy, you had to examine the life that had been lived as well as any doctrines that might be associated with the school of philosophy. This older tradition, I think, has lived on willy-nilly in our contemporary culture because the sense that self-examination is precious and important is at the base of so much in the Western tradition, not just in the philosophical tradition, but this assumption informs the theology of Augustine. It enters into the Catholic Church. It becomes very important in Protestantism. Mm-hmm. In my book, I talk about how I was raised in the Midwest as a Lutheran, and it was normative for a Lutheran that you were supposed to examine yourself, and you should live in accord with your true beliefs. So the colloquial sense that we have in America today that people either have integrity or they're hypocrites is a derivative, a kind of vernacular derivative of this tradition. And I think you see it most enforced in religious institutions. So if a priest is discovered to have engaged in sexual misconduct, that would be grounds for dismissal from the priesthood. If a modern-day academic philosopher were found to have engaged in sexual misconduct, everybody would yawn unless it was with a student, and then they would be disciplined.
We have a congressman today who's out on his ear because he was advertising for sex on Craigslist, showing his biceps.
Yeah, I wonder what the whole backstory with that is.
I don't know how much Socrates, he's been reading. I mean, it goes back, as you remind us, to the Delphic oracles saying, you know, saying, know thyself. Socrates, as Plato reports, saying the unexamined life is not worth living, brings us to your book title, Examined Lives. And then to that time, and you remind us again, John Stuart Mill learned what? Classical Greek very, very early so that he could go back and read step by step how the great ones had lived, how they had acted out, I guess, presumably he was hoping to find, their philosophies.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I discovered in writing the book, there were things that I really didn't understand when I began, but one of the things that was striking is the extent to which up through the Victorian period, the reading of these lives was constitutive of a proper gentleman's education, particularly people who were being prepared to enter the ruling class or ruling elite of their respective societies. And I suppose the short reason why this would be so is that it was taken for granted that if you were to study Socrates, Plato, Seneca, you might learn lessons in self-control, and that if you were able to rule your own impulses, it might better prepare you to rule over others in government.
Now, is your goal to throw all that out the window? I mean, you know, you're telling us Diogenes was masturbating in the street to prove part of his philosophy. Are you here to tell us that philosophy is a bunch of bunk because they didn't live what they taught?
Tom, are you against masturbating in the street?
I won't take a stand on it. I far be it from me. He's Diogenes. I'm just Tom. But is that what you're sitting
out? Well, Diogenes did this for a reason. He said, you know, I wish I could satisfy my hunger simply by rubbing my stomach. Wouldn't it be a better world if life were so simple?
he found his way on the sex front, not the hunger front, not that simple.
Well, yeah. It turns out he was more self-sufficient there. No, I don't want to throw out this tradition because the tradition has built into it failure. And
are you here for debunking or you're here for reviewing or, you know, what's this examination you're doing? I mean, you remind us of the lives of the eminent philosophers by Diogenes, how do you say, Laertius?
Laertius. Mm-hmm. Well, take a case like Seneca, who was a counselor to Nero. He clearly failed to embody or live up to many of the precepts he wrote about in his moral essays. But for Seneca, the point was he was trying. And it was the struggle to live up to an ideal of integrity that was very, very important. For somebody like Augustine, he also felt on his spiritual quest, which takes him through a whole variety of different schools of philosophy and different forms of religious belief in antiquity, that what he discovered in the course of this quest is that he was a creature of sin and errancy. And that is what prepared him to surrender to the grace of God. So the fact that people don't always live up to their ideals doesn't mean that this tradition is debunked and set aside. On the contrary, it's taken for granted as the tradition evolves that there will be setbacks and failures. And then it seems to me the question is this a worthwhile struggle to try to aim at integrity? And then there's the further question you can raise is, well, what counts as integrity? And different philosophers have different answers to that abstract question.
And then it gets even stranger. You quote Plato in the Republic right at the front of the book saying, you know, that those who start out on philosophy, who linger on it for a long time, most become quite queer, not to say completely vicious, while the ones who seem perfectly decent become useless. Plato warning, you know, watch out if you enter this into know thyself a track.
Well, it is also the case, it seems to me, that if you go down a rabbit hole of introspection, it can take you very far afield from the common concerns of other people in your immediate environment. So if you take the case of Socrates, one of the things I think that was made him very suspect in the eyes of his contemporaries was the fact he actually wasn't particularly interested in politics. And in ancient Athens, if you were a citizen, as he was, you were expected to be politically engaged. And so there's a real tension throughout this tradition of otherworldliness and thisworldliness. And you see it also in the evolution of religious institutions.
We'll take a short break here in just a second. I have to ask you, in the year 2010, why all Western philosophers? You know, why not Lao Tzu, Confucius, I don't know, the Vedas, Maimonides, the Vedas?
Because when I began this book, I didn't even really have that. I didn't know the ancient Greeks and Romans, and there's only so much one person can do in a mediocre lifetime. So, you know, maybe the next book will be the ones that were omitted, because it is a major omission.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great philosophers and life, theirs and ours, with James Miller. His new book has examined lives from Socrates to Nietzsche. And this book is tremendous, actually. I mean, I think there's a hunger out there these days. You see it in all kinds of fronts, Jim. People looking for guidance, and maybe once again looking for the practical proof in the pudding that people found some way to live it in life. Let's start to go through these a little bit with your help, sort of to the core of what they taught and the most important observations that you're making about how they lived. And I guess Socrates is the place to start. Is he, at least as Plato tells it, without blemish?
Well, as Plato tells it, yes, he comes across without blemish. But one of the problems is that the origins of Western biography and autobiography, as I discovered in writing this book, these are genres that are not strictly factual. They're intertwined with poetry, fiction, and moral edification. So if we take the account that we're given, say, in Plato's dialogue, The Apology, which purports to tell us how Socrates behaved at his trial, then he comes across as a person not only without blemish, but someone who claims that he only holds beliefs that he finds reasonable. He holds beliefs that are all consistent with each other, and that these beliefs that he holds are consistently, to the best of his ability, translated into conduct. And that is a very daunting standard of integrity.
The manner of his death itself became the sort of great triumph of proof of Socrates. What, I don't know, verity. What was he charged with, and how did his death come down through the thousands of years at this point, I guess, as the philosophical lesson?
Well, he was charged with impiety and corrupting the youth. He had attracted a large following, which was actually quite variegated. Some of his followers were very conservative. Some were Democrats. He, instead of availing himself of the usual expedients in Athens, which would have been to go into exile, he insisted on following to the letter of the law what the punishment was if found guilty, which he was. He was found guilty, and the punishment was death. And he famously drank hemlock in front of some of his disciples, and he becomes this martyr to the quest for wisdom, a martyr 400 years before the birth of Christ.
Which kind of laid out what? That he acted as he taught. Is he the one who put out this goal of trying to make ourselves as good as we could be? I mean, you write about he sort of retreated from regular society. He'd walk around the marketplace, as you remind us, and talk to everybody. But he was looking for humans to try. He said, the sculptors of marble statues should take pains to make the block of marble into the perfect likeness of a man. If they take all that trouble, why don't humans try to make themselves right into the perfect human? Is that where that impulse came from, that teaching?
Yeah, and I think that the martyrdom is important because it means not only is this a character who presents himself as consistent in his ideas and his conduct, but he's willing to die for what he believes. Martyrdom is a capstone of many other religious lives that are legendary and famous. What makes Socrates, I think, notably different from Confucius or Buddha or Jesus is that the consistency he strives for, he insists, really is built on a love of argument and dialogue, mm-hmm. back and forth, trying to understand what we really believe. So there is a kind of, if you will, rationalism built into his mode of life that is not particularly characteristic of some of the rival spiritual teachers from the same rough period.
And he stepped up and in some ways proved his case with the manner of his calm death. And I'm trying to figure how this rolls on through these biographies. I mean, you tell us, okay, then comes Plato, who both informs us of Socrates and has his own philosophy. What about his life? He did gymnastics. He wrestled in the Greek games. Those don't seem very surprising. Is that illuminating? I mean, that's what people did in those
days.
Well,
I think what was most surprising to me was to discover this story that was widely believed in antiquity, that Plato was the product of a virgin birth. Sound familiar?
A little, yeah.
So he was perceived as divine. His intelligence, his genius was so transcendental. And he was revered and his writings were sacralized and were treated as holy scripture in antiquity.
Wow.
And that helps to explain why his dialogues become such a persistent formative influence, not just on philosophy but on Christianity and Islam and even Judaism.
What about, let's go right on down your list, Diogenes. What was the core of his teaching and how did his life illuminate or obscure it?
Well, he is represented basically as the kind of, Woody Allen of antiquity or the Henny Youngman, to take a more vulgar example, because all we know about him seems to be he was a creature of one-liners. And he was very different from Socrates and Plato in that he made no effort to engage with the power structure of his day except by refusing its blandishments. Famously, Alexander the Great came to visit him. He lived in a tub because he wanted to live life as naturally as possible. And Diogenes was very cranky. And when Alexander introduced himself, he said, please step out of the way. You're standing in front of the sun.
This to Alexander the Great, but he brought on the whole sort of skeptic school that clearly is still with us today.
Well, it's, one of the things about some of these early philosophers, it's not entirely clear what they actually did or what they actually believed because it's such a tissue of legends and myths. But again, up through the Victorian period, Diogenes the Cynic was a great inspiration to comics, to painters, to sculptors. So there's a very rich lore that surrounds him.
Take us to Aristotle, the core of his teaching, how his life obscured or illuminated.
Well, Aristotle is the first philosopher to really stress that the good life is a contemplative life. And once you go down that path, you begin to open the door to seeing philosophy as primarily a theoretical rather than a practical pursuit. And that opens the possibility of actually retreating from public conduct or observable conduct as having anything all that important to do with philosophy. He's a voracious researcher. The surprise to me was that he basically was propped up and probably funded by the Macedonian Empire. And as a result of his friendship, he is said to have tutored Alexander the Great. As a result of his friendship with the Macedonians, he was seen as a collaborator with an alien empire. And when Alexander was killed, he ran from Athens, fearing for his safety. In that sense, he's the anti-Socrates, and for a couple hundred years, he was held in very low esteem by other Greek philosophers as a result of his conduct.
As noble and great as Aristotle is, I imagined a kind of snoozy life, but then you've got him maybe as an assassin of Alexander the Great, ultimately.
Well,
and
that
a drug
was
peddler.
One of this, as, well, yeah, these were the kinds of stories that circulated, and I have to say that most modern-day historians just ignore the stories, but the stories are so wild and so interesting. Alexander's father was likely a doctor, a surgeon, and he, in fact, would have had access to a pharmacy of drugs such as they were then available in antiquity. So that, I think, is the basis of that particular story.
There's something so geometric about ancient Greece. We just think of those clean temples, but things begin to get sort of have a familiar funk to them when you get to Seneca, philosopher to Nero, the Roman emperor. What did he teach, and how did he keep it up with that kind of job, Nero, no less?
Well, by then, I think, and this goes back to one of the themes that emerges in Plato and particularly his great dialogue, The Republic, there was a tradition of philosophers tutoring tyrants. Aristotle had obviously done it with Alexander the Great. And Seneca slotted right into what by then was a sort of traditional role for a philosopher. And in those days, you know, the division of labor wasn't as far, hadn't progressed as far as it has today. So a philosopher often was a speechwriter, a publicist, a kind of pastoral counselor to a young monarch. And Seneca preached a code of conduct that wasn't that different from what Socrates had preached. But, of course, selling this to somebody who had absolute power over an empire and could essentially order the assassination of anybody he wished with snapping his fingers, mm-hmm. and did. So part of what Seneca ends up doing is composing speeches on clemency and on mercy, which he then has Nero deliver. And this is an attempt to, some historians of the time, like Tacitus say, was an attempt by Seneca to restrain Nero, to convince him that he didn't need to just kill anybody who disagreed with him. It seemed to work for about 4 years, and then it stopped working, and eventually Nero was one of the victims of Seneca was one of the victims of Nero.
Did Seneca write? Did he feel like a failure with his student, this Emperor Nero? I mean, after all, the guy's seduced by his mother and famously sort of rash and violent. Did Seneca speak to that in his writings?
Not explicitly. I mean, his writings are more concerned with his interior self, and so there's a weird disconnection between this very public life he led and what we find in his moral and philosophical essays. It's in his tragedies that we come closest to the actual behavior of the emperors, and the tragedies are all based on Greek stories, but, you know, it's on stage in these tragedies that you find monstrous tyrants slaughtering people mercilessly.
We've got a lot of listeners calling in. I want to turn to them, but take us to Augustine because it's kind of fork in the road. I mean, you write that today in some ways we have now for many centuries and for some fewer, but been in a way cut off from old-time philosophy by first religion and mm-hmm. second science. A big fork in the road came with Augustine, who set out in a kind of old-fashioned philosophical quest but then became quite doctrinal around religion.
Well, I find Augustine to be absolutely fascinating and a very moving story. And in some ways, I think the times he lives in are perhaps close to our own times mm-hmm. because there's so many different forms of self-help, spirituality, religion, mm-hmm. philosophy on offer. And he experimented with a number of them. He was a Manichaean as a young man. He was a skeptic
light and dark.
Briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And Manichaeans believed the world was divided between good and evil, mm-hmm. and there was a titanic struggle between them. He was a follower of Plato for a while, but in midlife he – He had been going to church because his mother had raised him a Christian, but he really didn't believe, and he underwent a conversion experience and decided that he should become baptized and really follow Scripture and not just read the books of the philosophers. And he went back to his home area of North Africa, present-day Algeria, Tunisia, mm-hmm. It's that part of Africa. And he ended up becoming a bishop. And as a bishop, he found himself in a position of banning and punishing heretics, including people who were members of religious and philosophic sects that he himself, as a young man, had been part of. Mm-hmm. And his rationale was simple in a way. It's that I have found the truth, and why would I deprive my fellow struggling, miserable human beings of the what I know to be the truth, the revealed religion of Jesus Christ? Because it's the truth, and I have spent my life searching for the truth, it's my duty to make sure that everybody in my flock has a possibility of sharing in this good news.
That turned into a pretty strong stumbling block for a while to the old style of inquiry. We'll look at that and more. James Miller's new book is Examined Lives. We've got lots of feedback here on Facebook. Phil says the main challenge in living the examined life is continuing to live within the reality, quote-unquote, created by the vast numbers of the unexamining. Once you overcome that discomfort, there's no going back. Certainties become prisons. And here's one from John. Socrates told us the unexamined life is not worth living. At one point many years ago, when I was doing lots of psychotherapy, he writes, it occurred to me that the over-examined life ain't that great either. Jim in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi. I was wondering, in the context of politics and Western philosophers, how would they impact the political debate, liberal, conservative, what's going on, the polarization, you know, where they would stand in relation to that, I guess.
Very interesting. I don't know. You've got a dozen, Jim. Is there a center of gravity, and where would it sit in the American political spectrum today?
Well, I guess what I would say is that one of the chief preoccupations of Socrates, which recurs in many of my thinkers, is the admonition that everybody should struggle to think for him or herself and not take on faith any dogmas or doctrines. Now, obviously, there's some variation in my character so that at the end of his life, Augustine clearly was willing to force down the throats of people a catechism of beliefs he thought were the correct beliefs. But most of my philosophers were advocates of independent thinking. And one of the things that has struck me about much of the shouting that goes on in the bloviation in our contemporary 24/7 political news cycle is how locked into their own thought worlds people become on the left and the right. And essentially, they seek out through the internet and through cable television news sources that reinforce what they think they believe rather than questioning or seeking out questioning of those beliefs. And I think the most important lesson philosophy could teach us today is the importance of a certain humility about belief and an openness to hearing the beliefs of others and genuinely listening. In a polarized, hyper-partisan environment such as the one we're in, it's very hard to sort of slow down and listen to each other.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great philosophers and life, theirs and ours, with James Miller, author of the new Examined Lives, From Socrates to Nietzsche. He looks at their teachings. He looks at how they lived. Boy, Jim, listeners are really getting their teeth into this. Here's Jillian, who says on Facebook, for me, it's incredibly important to see how philosophers incorporated their ideas into their lives. Because if these ideas aren't lived but only spoken, what relevance can they have to reality? Then Kevin writes, he says, with few exceptions, such as Socrates, the great philosophers failed to live up to the standards they set for others. Still, he writes, their work remains invaluable for providing each of us with a vocabulary for the philosophical examination of our own lives. What do you say, Jim?
I think that's a good point. I mean, one of the things that the philosophical tradition is a repository of is categories and concepts. And much of the work that philosophy does today, academic philosophy, is in clarifying categories and concepts. And there's a lot of important work, I think, that can be done that is purely conceptual. And contemporary philosophy is still, in many ways, feeding on this legacy it's inherited of some of the questions that prior philosophers have wrestled with. So even though I myself am greatly interested in how classical philosophers struggled to live according to their ideas, there's no question that some of the work of modern philosophy can be very helpful to society quite independently of the lives of the philosophers who advance those categories and concepts.
No question, though, in the way their lives have fallen out of the, you know, among the academic contemporary philosophers, it's so high concept and so into doctrine that maybe that's part of the reason philosophy has lost a bigger following. Nancy in Pocatello, Idaho, you're on the air, Nancy.
Thanks very much for the discussion. This is the world in which I live every day. I'd like to maybe suggest that one place you can look for relevance and philosophy, which is what some of the comments have been aimed at, is in song lyrics. And really good lyricists and songwriters address some of these issues and tensions for living in your everyday life.
Now that's my interesting.
Favorite,
yeah, who is your favorite, Nancy?
My favorite songwriter, and I do some analysis of his work and the philosophies in his songwriting, is Jacob Dylan. And he talks a lot about living with paradoxes, controlling what you can control, and being committed to the ideas and the nature of who you are, self-determination, motivation, and letting go what you can't control.
Jacob Dylan, you know, Bob Dylan's son. Now, does it matter to you, if I may ask, Nancy, does it matter to you then? Here's a songwriter. He's got access to a wide public today, maybe more than some academic philosophers now. You find value in the philosophy you find in his lyrics. Does it matter to you how he lives, whether or not he follows those, or are the ideas enough for you?
That's an important consideration, but it's not as important to kind of know how the person lives as it is to find some strength and some language and some power in finding how to live yourself. I do believe that this particular lyricist does live that, but I'm not sure that I don't know that we can go to intentions and how to think as much as getting things from their messages themselves.
Nancy and Pocatello, I really appreciate your call. Jim Miller, I wonder what you're thinking about that. I mean, you remind us in your book that philosophers had something much closer to rock star status back in the day. Does that make songwriters today? Does it give them access to that role? The idea that they're dealing with ideas, they're dealing sometimes with how to live. They are, for some people, for Nancy, they're teachers.
When I wrote my previous book, which is a history of rock and roll, early years of it from 1947 to 1977, I really talked about it in the conclusion of that book, the extent to which rock and roll inherited the romantic role of the great artist, who is a kind of avatar of wisdom. It's a role that one finds embodied by, Beethoven, Wagner, Goethe. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there is in many national traditions of literature as well as in contemporary pop culture, there has been a slippage of some of the classic concerns of ancient philosophy over into the realms of music, literature, poetry.
And losing what concerns, perhaps, would you say?
losing what concerns?
Yeah, you said there's been slippage in the classic concerns. I
think you gain a certain power because there are feelings and sentiments you can express in media other than rational thought that are incredibly powerful. What you lose is focus on giving reasons and arguments for what you believe. And that it's hard to do that if you're staging an opera, even if there could be the most profound philosophical reflection behind the libretto of that opera.
Absolutely. Nancy, thanks. Let's get another Nancy in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air with James Miller. Nancy, thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to ask Mr. Miller if he also noticed the practicality of Socrates, for instance, and on down through today to Dr. Peter Singer, who is a well-known philosopher today. In Socrates and his student Glaucon's discourse about the slaughterhouse leading to the battlefield, that theme has carried through so many philosophers through the ages, Pythagoras, and on down to Dr. Peter Singer. There are too many to name.
Mm.
And that practicality of behavior, as some of the callers have already mentioned, that is so important because we can talk and talk and think and, suppose and so on ourselves as philosophers. But what do we do with all of that? How do we behave? And where is that fundamental string running through all of these philosophers and our own behavior today that makes any difference other than just reading? Not that I don't like to read, and I'm a former teacher and journalism teacher.
Mm-hmm. But bring it to behavior, perfect. You say. Bring it to behavior.
Yes, what's belief and behavior can be a very different thing.
Nancy, I appreciate your call. Do you see, Jim, I don't know if this is possible to do, but you've sunk into this so deeply here. Was there a population among humans that lived more deliberate lives connecting belief and behavior in the past? Have we got a more disconnected, worlds of belief and behavior today? Is it possible to look at that over time and make any sort of, a generalization?
Yeah, I think it is probably possible. I was curious what the caller meant by practicality of behavior, but in her remarks. But
I think bringing the philosophy into behavior in a practiced way, perhaps.
Okay. But what I would say is that for most of the early philosophers, they just took for granted that philosophy was a very peculiar way of life. That only a few people would undertake, and that Aristotle is quite explicit that the preconditions for a contemplative life involve having a lot of money and free time. And for most of humanity, for most of history, those preconditions are not met. So the question of what we can do today in a democratic society that's infinitely more complicated than ancient Greece is a very good one. And it is posed by a contemporary philosopher like Singer, who has written a classic book on vegetarianism and also an interesting book on global justice, that if you were to take seriously what he says, you would, of course, stop eating meat and you would work hard to redistribute wealth from rich countries to poor countries. Singer himself, who I have met several times, actually acts out those beliefs. He's an example of a modern philosopher who doesn't just talk the talk, he walks it.
Let's go to Brent in Louisville, Kentucky. Brent, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would just like to mention earlier, you said science tends to deprive us of this philosophy, but I actually find the person I look to for my philosophy is Carl Sagan. He had a photograph. He was an astrophysicist. He had a photograph of the Earth amidst a star field, and the Earth was just a point of pale blue light amongst millions and billions of stars. And he had a whole speech about how the history of human civilization and the history of our species is But on this small point, that's distinguishable unless you what you're looking for.
Brent, you're breaking up a little bit for us, but let me take Carl Sagan, of course, bring science back into the conversation. What about science and the philosophical, meditation on how to live? Has science pulled the rug out from underneath that somehow? Has it bolstered it? How do you see it, Jim?
Well, the transitional person in my book that's really important is Descartes, mm-hmm. because he's commonly seen as the father, one of the fathers of modern science, with good reason, since some of his theories are embodied in GPS systems today.
Look for the facts. Look for the proofs.
Well, and he was also a master of mathematics, mm-hmm. and mapping space mathematically. Mm-hmm. So what I think happens is that once you begin – once we see the rise of modern natural science, it becomes more and more specialized, and it requires greater degrees of specialized training to even enter into the discourse and the process of discovery of natural science. And philosophers who were interested in these modes of inquiry increasingly become specialized, and that's what they do. They stop paying that much attention to the way they live or ethics as or morality. And so you have the rise of a very specialized group of natural scientists and philosophers who study very specialized problems in mathematics and logic. But you're right to point out that there are certain figures in modern science that do represent themselves to they have a capacity to express in a summary form some of the wonder and awe of that's produced by their specialized modes of inquiry. Sagan's a good example. Einstein is, of course, the great 20th century legendary scientist. Stephen Hawking today, although Hawking in his new book goes out of his way to explain that philosophers are just completely a waste of time and irrelevant, and people should just read books by people like him.
Yeah, right, to take that. We've got Karen here. She looks to the stories from Rousseau. She writes online, one of the great ironies is that Rousseau, who abandoned his five children, as you write, Jim, wrote a book about how to raise children, Emile. Karen writes, what's interesting is that he seems to have done some self-examination. At the beginning of Emile, he refers to himself as Jean-Jacques as opposed to Rousseau and specifies that he has imagined himself as a better, more patient person who has all the capabilities necessary to raise a child. But, of course, in life, as you remind us, Jim, he had these five children that he put in foundling homes where children routinely died in those days. That hardly lined up with his philosophy.
True. And towards the end of his life, Rousseau, in effect, I think just throws up his hands and said, basically, I can't help it. I live a life in contradiction with myself. But the one thing I will always do is tell the truth about these contradictions. We know as much as we know about Rousseau's life and the inconsistencies in his life, in part because he wrote not one but three books of confessions, which are abject often, but at the same time deeply moving. So the paradox of Rousseau is that at the same time he reveals all of his personal foibles and weaknesses, in certainly the first generation of readers who devoured these books in 18th century France, they thought all the more highly of him because he was so honest about his own personal failings.
We get one more call here. Gail in Hartford, Connecticut. Gail, thanks for calling. You're on the air with James Miller.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that I myself have been living an examined life for about 15 years now as part of getting back to myself after having lived in an abusive marriage for a long time.
And so is this new path driving you crazy or helping you, Gail?
It's really helped me. And what I've noticed through practice of meditation, yoga, awareness, understanding the concept of living with intention, understanding the concept that it's all a choice, and that I can reveal the story I wish to reveal about myself, and that can change as I grow, and understanding that once you're on that path, you're not getting off. It's one of awareness and helping to live grounded.
Gil, our time is short. Let us pick it up right there, if I may. Jim, what about this? It's very popular today, the sort of yogic path, the awareness path. Is that a plunge into philosophy, or is that a skate away from it to something else?
Well, I tend to have a fairly expansive view of philosophy as a quest for wisdom and well-being, and that most academic philosophers would think it has nothing to do with philosophy. But I think if you look back to the time of Augustine and compare it to our own time, to repeat something I said earlier, we live in a world in which there are many avenues that are laid out for ways to live life and to do it thoughtfully. And philosophy, narrowly construed, is one among many such paths.
At the end of it, Plato says, you know, if you care too much about philosophy, you end up kind of wigged out. Where do you come down, Jim?
I was raised in a tradition of introspection and self-examination, and for all of the times I felt tormented by it, I wouldn't give it up for anything.
We're glad for that, and glad that this great dozen that you look at in the book never gave it up either. James Miller is the author of Examined Lives, From Socrates to Nietzsche. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Miller.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.